You've come to the right place. It's the Smart Driving Cars podcast. I'm Fred Fishkin, along with the faculty chair of autonomous vehicle engineering at Princeton University, Alan Kornhauser. Hi, Alan.
Good evening, Fred.
Good evening. And we are very happy to have joining us once again the publisher of The Dispatcher, based in Sweden, Michael Senna. Thanks for being here again, Michael.
My pleasure. Good to hear you.
Great to have you, Michael.
Thank you.
In the April edition of The Dispatcher, you take a look at the Symposium on the Future Networked Car, which took place earlier in March at the Geneva International Motor Show. There were multiple sessions, the first titled Connected and Automated Vehicles at the Crossroads to Success. What should our listeners know about some of the key points there?
The main point was that there was one person on the panel who was defending the honor of the 802.11p DSRC vehicle-to-vehicle communication of the person from Volkswagen, and the rest of the panel were pretty much in favor of the alternative, which is cellular V2I. It was a good discussion. The points that were made in favor of the DSRC solution principally came down to, it's done. We have a standard. We can do it now. We don't have to wait for another year until everything is standardized with cellular V2I. It's free, so let's get started with it. That panel was moderated by Russ Shields, who has been a staunch advocate of the cellular approach and a staunch opponent of the Wi-Fi based approach. It was a lively discussion, and I'm not really sure that the rest of the panel actually, in terms of the arguments, came out on top, because there are a number of companies, not the least of which are the two largest automobile companies, Toyota and Volkswagen, who decided to move ahead with the Wi-Fi ITS G5 here in Europe and Wave in the United States approach to V2X. What did you think, Alan? You listening to that debate, that discussion?
It amazes me we're still having the discussion. I was surprised at the Volkswagen, sitting there and continuing to argue for the DSRC. And I don't know. I guess my opinion is I think they've lost. And that it's time to move on.
Yeah. Well, I'm not. I really don't know how this is going to work with them making a decision to go ahead with Toyota doing the same. I'm sure that by the time the cellular V2X V2I comes on board in, let's say, a year's time, we're moving closer to 5G. We have some implementations of the first phase of 5G. It'll be overtaken, but it's just a pity that people are going to be wasting money putting this in vehicles, and we'll have two options out there. And I don't know. I think that there are enough. There's one country that I know in last year's discussion, Austria said, we're going to put this into our infrastructure. So on all of the highways that are run by the state, the toll roads, they're putting in this DSRC based solution. The Netherlands has also decided that they're going to be doing something similar. So there seem to be enough organizations from the government to the private sector who are doing this, because they feel that there's enough reason to save lives in the short term. But if it's like clapping with one hand, if you have this solution, you can't communicate with someone who doesn't. And it's going it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out in the next 2 years before the cellular solutions start to come online.
Right, and I guess the issue with DSRC is that the infrastructure needs to put in its own communication system that is used by nothing else but the vehicles for these safety issues. And but if one goes to the cellular, then the cellular is being used by everybody else. In a sense, it's being paid for by everybody else, And while a few motorways might, in fact, install the DSRC, the opportunities to have it installed anywhere else is essentially close to zero. So yeah. I don't think it has a chance to scale. And if this doesn't scale, then it's going to be useless, right?
Yeah, exactly. So. The original argument in favor of it was exactly the same argument that was used for the European eCall. If you don't, initially with the first design, it didn't require a SIM card. You needed a modem in the car, but to dial 112, but you didn't need to have a SIM card. Then, as they progressed through the standards during the 12 years that they were working on it, they found that if you don't have a SIM card, you can't call back. And if the line breaks, if something occurs, which of course may occur, and when you have a crash, it's worthless because you can't call back to the modem in the car. So once they made that decision, you needed to have an IMSI, and then you had to have a SIM card in the vehicle. So you may not pay for a phone call. Somebody pays 112. The networks, the mobile network operators, pay for that 112 call. The person making it doesn't. But it was the same with DSRC. They said, well, this is free. You don't need to have a modem. It's Wi-Fi. You put the hardware in the vehicle, and you go ahead and use it. But it's the same. They have with cellular V2X. It's equivalent in terms of the solution. You have a short range without necessarily having to go into the cellular network to be able to communicate. And so that advantage disappeared. I think people were just so frustrated after having worked on the standard for so long, and principally the people in IEEE, that they said, we don't care. We want to move forward with this, and we want to put it in as quickly as possible because it's going to save lives. So that's what's happening.
Interesting. The second session sounds like it was related in some ways to the first, focused on cybersecurity and automotive systems.
Yeah, well, I have the privilege of having a group who, really, all of them on the panel were experts in one way or another in this whole issue. And I think that the takeaway there was somebody asked the question, it sounds hopeless. We don't have with our PCs and their phones, everything is being hacked. Is this going to be the case with cars? If everything is connected, is the opportunity there to do exactly the same thing that's being done with our PCs? And pretty much everyone said the same thing. And although it sounds hopeless, there are enough people working on this right now in standards, not the least of which are in the ITU standards organization, this Working Party 29. And I know they're working diligently at this because I started working with the ITU about 4 years ago with a report that I did on this subject. We haven't had those kinds of events far, everyone pretty much said it's something may happen, but the likelihood is much less if we do what should be done, which is security by design, end-to-end security, with all the acknowledgments that are necessary and to really design this in, and to make sure that the communication that's dealing with the onboard systems that steer, that brake are securely behind enough firewalls to make sure that you can't get at them. And if you do, you get at one car and not at thousands or millions of cars that are all connected to the same communication network. So, I felt we are making progress in this area, and the difference between the V2X, there aren't multiple camps. There aren't people who are working across purposes. There are lots of people who are working on all of the components that are necessary for having a secure communication and connectivity with the vehicle.
Yeah, I agree with respect to the cybersecurity. I think everybody is working to the same goal and to the same end, and everybody is sort of is supporting themselves, and there aren't these cross purposes. And then also with respect to the whole attack problem, the whole transportation system is very susceptible to hacking that is non-digital in nature. I mean, how often do we have car bombs going off in markets around the world where, there are good old humans driving the darn things? And I don't know that, if for those who really want to cause that kind of harm, I just don't see them going the digital route. It's too easy to recruit just a suicide bomber to go power one of these things. You take even the World Trade Center bombing in the basement. It's some guy driving a van full of explosives or full of whatever and going in there. So I think yes, the cybersecurity issue is an issue, but I think security of our transport systems from just human intervention probably is still a bigger problem than the cybersecurity problem.
Yeah, I agree.
The third session was titled Automated Capabilities and AI in the Vehicle, Status and Expectations. And Alan, you were a party to that.
Yes, I was a party, but yes, and it was an interesting discussion with respect to all that. I think as I continue to evolve on that, I think that remains a still valuable part of the technological evolution for us to get to a point, at least in some domains where we can offer rides completely from origin to destination using technology instead of a driver. And of course, where I'm evolving on that is a fleet operation and focused on the mobility disadvantage, because that's where this kind of, as I call them, mobility machines can actually go out and deliver mobility to those who can benefit most by having that mobility offered to them. And I think with that as a focus, and to do it in the smaller domains of where it's valuable to that population, and at a scale that's the scale of that population, is a really good way for us to get started and to continue to provide and have the opportunity to provide enormous value to society. So that's where I've gotten myself completely focused on. I felt kind of funny at the Geneva Auto Show with all the money that's sitting there, talking about trying to provide mobility to the poor. I thought I was afraid of maybe getting stoned or something. I don't know. Everybody treated me well. I don't think a lot of the people at the Geneva Auto Show think too often about the poor.
No.
And their mobility needs. So, Michael, what are your thoughts?
Well, the main thought that I had on the session, I mean, Roger is a fantastic moderator.
Yes.
But I really don't feel that the session actually got to the point of AI. I mean, there were a lot of points made on you know, should we have a ton of self-driving vehicles, and if you know, if we do, how should they be used? But you know, we, as I said in the newsletter, the question that comes down to whether the robots driving vehicle are using neural networks, deep learning, or machine learning to perform the driving task. No one was really picking up on this issue. So the point of the session, I say collective, not I alone. I mean, I got this idea from The Economist some months ago that the whole idea of using artificial intelligence, I think, is a misnomer. I mean, the artificial intelligence is based on the collective, that we're providing tons and tons of data that's being processed and then fed into computers that are working in so-called an intelligent way. We really didn't get into that in the discussion. So I think for next year, I'm going to try to emphasize on the program committee that we really should try to focus on that particular issue, because I think, you know, in the end, it's something that we really need to discuss on both sides. I mean, I feel strongly that we have to have both sides of this discussion going on. I read in the newspaper, I think it was this morning or maybe yesterday, a plane left London City Airport for Dusseldorf. And when it landed and the announcement came over, welcome to Edinburgh, the plane had been redirected in the air. I guess the pilots were doing something else and not looking at the compass, because, you know, flying directly east to get to Dusseldorf and flying directly north to get to Edinburgh are two very different things. But apparently nobody understood that the plane was going to someplace completely different, almost the same distance. And then the pilot came on and said, you know, we know that you wanted to go to Dusseldorf, but is there anybody here who'd like to, you know, to get off and go to Edinburgh instead? It's like, okay, so some intelligence took that plane and did something that absolutely no one on the plane, pilots, crew, or passengers, had any idea of. I mean, I can call that artificial intelligence, because it was definitely not a real experience. But I think we need to address this issue, I'm hoping that we see a little bit more on both sides, that it's good, it's bad, and let's discuss if it's bad, how to make it good, and if it's good, how to make it better.
Well, it's a really deep question, and please send me the link to that, because I want to put that in the Smart Driving Car newsletter. But still on the AI piece, I had the pleasure this morning of spending 2 hours in basically in the kitchen of John Hopfield, who's I guess one of the fathers of neural networks and so on, and mm-hmm. basically. Our discussion was totally focused, the two of us, on adversarial issues and really trying to understand what's going on in some of these constructs of deep learning and so on, and that are data dependent yet exhibit some really chilling situations where you, as I like to put it, you have a very small tail wagging a very big dog, and yeah. where, you know, very, very small changes in the input data all of a sudden gives you completely different answers. Now, you know, as humans, we understand that in fact, there can be illusions. Escher made a living off of it, and so that we don't know whether or not the stairs are down or whatever. But some situations that people are beginning to uncover with these begin to say, my goodness, just having some folks are talking about, data-driven deep learning, machine learning, and all this stuff on this. And when you don't really understand the whys of it are really challenging. A few years back with one of my graduate students, Chen Yi Chen, when we were really, I guess, doing the beginning of using virtual reality data to train networks to do driving. You know, there's a so-called end-to-end network, which you train, in which the output just is, you know, the three things that you can do when you're driving. You can turn the steering wheel, you can hit the brake, or you can hit the gas. And you know, we could just never get stable outputs of such a things in simulation. But if we sort of did a network that was generating what we would call the affordances, the physical representations of the driving environment, where you are relative to the edges that it detected, how far back you are from the car ahead of you, is there a car to the side of you, and these kinds of things, and then using that in a control system, then we would get much better performance. And to us, the obvious advantage of doing it the second way is that then we could understand the output that it was giving us in terms of things that we understand as inputs to then what we do to stay in the lane and not crash, as opposed to, oh my goodness, it just told us to turn the steering wheel to the right and we have no idea where in hell that came from. And so you know, there are these issues that abound in many of these so-called deep learning AI approaches to the problem. So, yes, we've made a lot of progress in recognizing whether or not it's a dog or a cat. But even in things that we ran into with respect to recognition of stop signs, in some sense, we may not even recognize a stop sign as we approach a stop sign. We recognize the context in which a stop sign is contained, and then basically that context ends up suggesting that there's a stop sign and we better slow up. And so all of these sorts of elements are really not contained in any of these approaches. So yes, there's a lot of discussion to have in those particular areas. And unfortunately, we didn't get there this year. Let's get there next year.
Yeah. But one last thing on this. This Boeing crash is something that I'm going to be writing about in the next issue. It is directly related to everything that we're doing in the automobile industry. The fact is that the systems that are used for driving cars without humans are based on sensors, and there are all kinds of sensors that deliver the information that's necessary or the data that's necessary to create a result that a computer, robot, someone's system operating without human involvement will make decisions on. And sensors are not infallible. They break. In the case of with the Boeing that landed in the ocean, if they freeze, we can't depend 100% on sensors that will always do their job.
Yeah, although in the Boeing situation, my goodness, if one looks at the design of the autopilot or the design of that system and what they didn't do, I mean, you know, in the Lion Air crash, in fact, you have two angle of attack sensors. The two sensors are one's on one side of the fuselage, the other one's on the other side. One's giving you one value, the other one's giving you another value. Nowhere in the system they designed did they compare those values, first of all. Secondly, as the thing is taxiing down the runway, one of the sensors is showing 0 degrees angle of attack. The other one is showing something like 10 degrees angle of attack. There's no logic put into that system that says, oh, my goodness, we're going down the runway. I wonder what the angle of attack should be as we're going down the runway. 0 degrees or something close to zero. I mean, there should have been alarms. And then in the MAX 8, the Norwegian Air actually sent out an email saying they chose not to get the extra added feature. There was an extra added feature that Boeing of a light that would indicate and compare the angle of attack of one sensor value with the other one and turn on if they disagreed to warn the pilots. And one has to say, oh my goodness, you know, how much must that light cost? I mean, how did, and they claim they didn't do it because no regulatory agency in Europe required them to do that and nobody else was buying it. But in fact, probably the reason why they did it is because if Boeing were to put that light on the display panel that had been that is now screens instead of the normal analog displays, then that would have rendered the cockpit sufficiently different from a normal 737, such that Norwegian Airline would have had to their pilots and put them in simulators. So in fact, the probable reason why they chose not to do that is not because of the extra cost of the safety thing, is because of the extra cost associated with the extra training that the pilots might have. But of course, they didn't say that, but that's complete speculation on my part. So any of the listeners didn't, you know, but think about it.
I think I did read that there was a price tag of something like $30,000. For the future.
Can you imagine write some code and put it this? I mean, if you tell that to any Tesla person who's like, displays on the screen in a Tesla, and they say $30,000 for that, they might like go nuts. I mean, are you kidding? Whatever. Redundancy, autopilots were designed when? 50 years ago, something like that. And in fact, if one looks at the redundancy situation and the fact that autopilots, they have two systems running, you know, and those systems don't talk to each other. And the one is running in case the other one breaks down. Well, you know, that was kind of good when we were dealing with analog circuits and things like that. When one's dealing in the digital world, oh my goodness! I mean, I don't think anybody would design a system like that. So, I don't know. We all think that the airline industry is so up to speed, but of all the discussions we had at the conference with respect to standards and so on, can you imagine what must exist with respect to the displays and any control system you put in an airplane? What kind of, I don't know, whatever. No wonder the FAA requires industry to figure out what's going on, because, you know, how would you have enough people that are up to speed enough to understand all that stuff? Anyway, I don't know. It's tough, though.
Moving on here, session 4, Michael, was titled The Deployment of Automated Mobility Services. And I suppose that ties into something else that you talk about in the dispatcher, the new edition, taking a look at what's going on with Voyage and driverless mobility service in the Villages retirement community down in Florida.
Well, that's where I thought it might lead. But that session was specifically allocated to, say, the public sector. We normally would have, in past conferences, there have been three sessions, and we'd sprinkle into each one of the sessions something related to the folks who are working in the public sector. This one's specifically given to people working in like Transport for London and people working in the Commission. And I had thought that it would focus a bit more on what's really happening in our cities today with buses and competing with scooters. I don't know if you're seeing that as much as we're seeing it here. But I mean, the proliferation of scooters in Stockholm is just, it's gone crazy. We've got four companies now that are delivering scooters, and they're all over the place. And so combined with the bicycles and now battery operated bicycles taking up space on the street and really competing with public transportation. And then we did discuss it a bit. I mean, in an exchange directly, Alan was sitting next to me and we were kind of communicating with the panel as they were presenting. But one of the things that was said, which really has nothing to do with mobility or public sector, was that one of the panelists said that we're using this fact as a fact that 90% or 95% often of the accidents that occur are attributable to human beings. And I've always had trouble with that because there's so many things that happen when an accident occurs that you can't say it's the human factor that caused that. If you take the human out of it, then you're going to have 90% of those accidents aren't going to happen anymore. So that was one of the, I think, the main points that came out of the discussion. But I think there again, that for next year, a little bit more of a focus on where is the transport, public transport, really going, particularly in cities. What's happening to buses? How are buses and undergrounds and bicycles and scooters and all of these other, how are they working together? Or are we at a point right now where we're just going to have to throw all the cards up in the air and see where they fall and eventually try to pick them up and put some order to it? I think, it was at the end of the day, and I think there were a number of people were just listening. Also, the main difference with that session was that there were presentations that were given as opposed to the panel discussion. And I think that's an important point to make to your listeners. The ITU Future Network CAR is a panel format. So the three sessions before this were all with panels, moderated questions, and real discussion that went on between the panelists and also between the panelists and the participants and the 200 people sitting in the audience. So I think that's the main difference between this conference and any of the other conferences that we have.
Interesting. And you did talk about in your new edition of the Dispatcher, though, what is going on down in Florida in the villages with Voyage. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I think it's a good place if you're going to try to implement in a controlled environment where you've got everybody is pretty much the same age. They've all got walking around or driving around at about the same speed. You own the roads. And if you can provide a solution to mobility where people who may continue to want to drive their cars but need a little extra help. And this is a really good way of testing it. So I think that the concept of putting more self-driving and more assisted driving into a community where people are more tend to be up in age is a good way it's a good opportunity to provide both a service and to test the concept of self-driving in a more safe way. You don't have lots of people zooming around in cars, and you can put people in safe cars as opposed to having people driving around in golf carts, which are not the safest, even though you don't have the same kind of weather conditions as you would have up in the Northeast or up in the Wisconsin in the wintertime. I lived in Orlando for 2 years before making the move over to Sweden, and except for the thunderstorms at 5 o'clock every day, the main problem you had there was that it was just so hot that walking around wasn't a possibility. So I think that's another issue. Even if you are mobile and you can walk around, it's so hot down there that you really do want to be in an air-conditioned car. And I think if you can't drive, but you would like to be able to drive, I think it's a good opportunity to test the concept of self-driving.
Yeah, I agree, Michael. I think what Voyage is doing in both San Jose and villages and in the villages in Florida is really important. And I think, you know, we're so at the very beginning of this, and what we should do is really do as much as we can in the places where it both is easiest and can deliver the biggest value. And certainly those two communities fit that in spades, and so therefore it's really good. And as we learn and as we make it better, as it improves, I think then we can begin to leak out into other realms. You know, I'm still very focused at trying to actually bring this to the streets of Princeton and basically have it operate in the streets, the 25 mile an hour streets. One of the things that we're really trying to do here in Princeton is, of course, make everybody obey the darn speed limits. So I think one of the things that we're about to put in the newspaper, in the police blotter, where we've used to list the people or continue to list the people that get DWIs or smoke pot, that get arrested and so on, we're not going to start listing the people who get speeding tickets and how fast they were going, again, to try to embarrass the community into adhering to the speed limits. And in fact, I'm trying to get the town to buy, you know, these speed cameras that record your license plate, but instead of sending you a ticket and making money off of it, just listing the top 10 violators of the speed limits in Princeton every week in the weekly newspaper. And now for visitors, maybe they won't know about this, but I think at least the community will stop speeding around. And then once we have the people driving at 25 miles an hour or so around Princeton, town's not big, then maybe we can actually bring some of these driverless mobility services in so that the people who don't have either access to a car or are not able to drive a car for one reason or another, but can still use and participate in a ride, can have the mobility that the rest of us have available to us because we happen to have one of these cars attached to our hip all the time. So that's really what I'm focused on. And maybe this leads into our next discussion, but that's what I intend to have a major part of the summit that we're having at Princeton in the middle of May. We're also going to I got the university to agree and be on board to for us to do demonstrations here in New Jersey. Nobody's ever seen one of these things. Nobody's even, you know, had the opportunity to kick the tires. So, you know, we're going to set up a demonstration area where at least some people from the mobility disadvantaged community and the people that support that community can begin to take a look at some of these mobility opportunities to see if, in fact, they can do a better job of getting people around than getting a paratransit ride from New Jersey Transit that costs New Jersey Transit, I don't know, $65 a ride or something to deliver, and you have to wait around all day. And it's just terrible service. So anyway, that's kind of where we're going.
And as you said, Alan, that's just about a month and a half away now, the Smart Driving Car Summit. And the focus that you're talking about is really going to open up a lot of eyes. People, the perception of this technology and where it's going is pretty much in the opposite direction. And you'll be opening eyes.
Yeah, I think look, to develop these things to give me mobility, you know, it's going to improve my life, you know, epsilon, you know, very little. But my goodness, what I've been especially learning lately about communities, you know, in New Jersey, we have a low income housing requirement of every community. But guess where every community locates its low income housing? It locates it in cheap land. Why is that land cheap? It's because it's not near anything and it has no accessibility. And so, of course, now we basically stick these people out there where, hey, the rent might be cheap, but you have to have a car to go get a quart of milk. So, you know, as I like to say, cheap housing plus expensive mobility does not lead to inexpensive living. And so having maybe an opportunity to provide mobility in a way with these mobility machines in a restricted environment, but that environment includes being able to go to the library, being able to go to the Princeton Shopping Center, being able to go to some of the schools, being able to go to some of the clinics or some of the doctor's offices, and maybe even go to some of the shops. All within the community. You know, forget going out on the New Jersey Turnpike or going on the Autobahn at 450 miles an hour or however fast they drive there. I mean, let's get it started in places where, in fact, it can really enhance the quality of life of individuals that have really been left behind by our Autobahns. And so that's, I guess, that's what I'm focused on, and that's what we're going to try to, in part, talk about and discuss and demonstrate at the summit in the middle of May.
And for more information, people can go to smartdrivingcar.com. All the information you need about the summit is there. And that is it for this edition. We want to thank Michael Senna for joining us. Great to have you with us again, Michael.
My pleasure. Great to be here again.
Always great to have you, and you'll be at the summit, and you're supposed to handle the European views.
gearing up for it, Alan. Looking forward to it.
Yes, and we're looking very forward to having you join us. And, of course, you'll be at Princeton for your – how many – 3 years?
Oh, goodness. It's
goodness.
My 50th.
Oh, isn't that wonderful?
Yeah, the big 50.
Big 50. Geez, you aren't even 50 years old, are you, Michael?
No,
you graduated.
No,
you were still in the womb when you graduated from Princeton,
yeah.
Michael.
Huh? Yeah. It's not only the president who's got, you know, the ability to start school so early.
Anyway, it'll be great having you again, and we look forward to it, Michael.
Thank you.
Great having you.
Well, you can find us again at smartdrivingcar.com, on Anchor FM, Spotify, TuneIn, Apple, Google, Spreaker, SoundCloud, and wherever you get your podcast. Ask your smart speaker to play us too. You can find my tech reports at textination.com. I'm Fred Fishkin, along with Alan Kornhauser. Thank you for listening.